Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Neil Stavem, and nice to be back with you. Enjoyed some time away, heading in the western part of our great nation and enjoying mountain views and the fresh air and lots of those things. And there's a lot of people on the road these days, and we're going to talk today about other movements taking place. Christianity seems to be moving south, Islam kind of moving around the globe, and young adults are moving on. We're going to find out about that as we meet Generation Z, Understanding and Reaching the New Post-Christian World. That's the title of a great new book from James Emery White, who's been a guest of Connecting Faith here in the past, and I always enjoy the conversation with James, and he's back with us today. We're going to talk about this new generation that's going to be impacting us all in maybe more ways than we can imagine. They represent, the freshman class of 2015. For example, for them, Google has always existed. They've never licked a postage stamp. Hybrid automobiles have always been mass-produced. They've grown up treating Wi-Fi as an entitlement. The cell phones have been so ubiquitous in class that teachers don't know which students are using them to take notes and which ones are planning a party. The Lion King has always been on Broadway. And the therapeutic use of marijuana has always been legal in a growing number of American states. Just some of the characteristics that this new generation is dealing with and that we have to start thinking a little bit differently about. And so we're going to address it today with one of the great thought leaders and pastors of our time. James Emery White is the founding and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church. It's a suburban megachurch in Charlotte, North Carolina. One of the fastest-growing church starts in the United States. He is a former president of Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary and has authored several books, including The Rise of the Nuns, which I think we talked to them not that long ago, Rethinking the Church, What They Didn't Teach in Seminary, and The Church in an Age of Crisis. And we're honored to have him back to talk about the new book, Meet Generation Z. James, so good to have you back with us. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Neil.
So give us a little sense about some of the broad shifts that are going on. I mentioned there's a lot of movement going on. There's some major shifts on the religious scene. Let's start with that.
Well, there are. We are at a major turning point, I think, culturally, and so there's a lot to choose from in terms of what's the most important. You mentioned the movement of Christianity southward. By the year 2050, only one Christian out of five actually will be a non-Latino white person. And the entire center of gravity of the Christian world really is shifting to the Southern Hemisphere. You mentioned the rise of Islam, and appropriately so. And we also have what's going to happen in China in terms of when or if Marxism falls, what will take its place, and what really is there in the surfacing of the underground Christian church. Marriage and family are being completely redefined as we speak. And so it is a new day in terms of family being recast in light entirely of personal desire. The doctrine of humanity is huge right now in terms of wrestling with what that means in light of technological advances because of the moral questions that are being raised by new technological advances. But I argue in the book that the biggest shift of all, the one that we need to be mindful of more than any, is really that there's been a second fall. And here's what I mean by that. Many of your listeners may be familiar, obviously, with the first fall when Adam and Eve were kicked out of the Garden of Eden. The second fall is when we returned the favor and we have kicked God out of the garden of our lives. We really are living right now for the first time in what can be truly called a post-Christian moment, at least in the United States. And that changes everything. When you are post-Christian, that simply means that you are after the era, after the time when Christianity was the dominant worldview, when it was the dominant cultural influence. It no longer is by any stretch of the imagination. So that's what's meant by post-Christian culture. And I think that's the defining mark of our day.
You know, it's hard for, as I was thinking about that, me and I think probably many others to fully comprehend what that there wouldn't be some awareness of at least some aspects of the gospel. I mean, what does it really mean to be in a post-Christian era? And we'll talk about this generation that's growing up in it.
Well, there's a couple of things that I think does afford a nice bridge into the conversation of the of Generation Z. Right now, you had mentioned my earlier book, The Rise of the Nuns. Right now, even since that book came out, the numbers have risen in a stunning way. So that now one out of every four Americans would consider themselves a nothing, you know, when it comes to checking the box of are you Christian or Presbyterian or Methodist or Catholic or whatever. One out of every four check, I'm nothing. I'm a nun, N-O-N-E. Well, that's just a reflection of this post-Christian culture. When you have a post-Christian generation like Generation Z, which is the first generation that is the product of a post-Christian culture, in other words, they haven't known anything but, it really does mean that there's not simple spiritual illiteracy or biblical illiteracy, both of which are apparent. They don't even have the memory of a gospel. And even more than that, it's not like they're thinking about Christianity and rejecting it. They're not thinking about it at all. That's how decisive this is for that generation in terms of being post-Christian.
Well, give us a little sense of this group of people. I mean, we just sort of tease some of the, you know, the highlights. The Beloit College does that, you know, every year, observes, you know, some of the changes taking place in the new freshman class. But give us a little sense of this is no small group of people either, is it?
No, I'm glad you raised that. One of the reasons why this is such an important thing to be discussing is that Generation Z right now is the largest demographic group right now that we have. There are more members of Generation Z than millennials, than baby boomers, than busters, than anybody. So you're talking about the largest generation. Essentially those born between 1995 and 2010. So we're talking about people under the age of 25. And so when you have the largest generation that is also the first one that is a product of a post-Christian culture, you're talking about two things. You're talking about a group that will not simply influence culture in the future, they will be culture in the future. Second, because they are the first product of a post-Christian culture and they are the largest cohort, they will be the heart of the church's mission field for the foreseeable future, which makes them incredibly important to understand and very relevant to everything that certainly the church and Christian ministry should be about. In terms of Marx, Neil, there's so much about, obviously, them that's worth noting that I go over in the book, but I'll give you a couple of three things that have set them apart from other generations. One, they are recession-marked. Terrorism and recession have been the norm for them. And so that's why they are so caught up in these visions of a dystopian future. And the movies and the books that they make popular all have this dystopian view of the future, whether it's you know, Maze Runner things or Mockingjay and Hunger Games or even something on TV like Walking Dead. This is where their thinking is. But because they have been so recession-marked, it's made them, and shocked by terrorism, it's made them extremely independent and entrepreneurial. And so that's kind of the positive flip side of this. They really do want to be independent of things. They don't want to be subject to things. And they really want to be work very hard to make the world a better place. They feel like it almost depends on them. So that's one thing about them. And you and I were talking off the air before we got started about why are so many, you know, jumped on Bernie Sanders' bandwagon and socialism and such. This is why. When you have had the kind of economic world that they have lived in from, you know, that they have no memory of anything other than that, it makes you wide open to things like socialism. They certainly don't have any kind of guiding worldview that would war against that. And so when they've been through the kind of economic crisis and the deep recessions that, you know, they've experienced, it makes them open to it. Another significant mark, and this is one that cannot be understated and could fill an entire series of conversations you're not going to have. It's how this is the first generation that grew up with the iPhone, which means, that's not a trite, trivial thing. That means they grew up with the internet in their pocket. And that's wildly different. That separates them alone from millennials in such a powerful way that it would be hard to understate. It means that they have had, it's affected their sense of how they connect with other people. It affects their sense of community and who their friends are. It affects everything about their personal lives. They grew up with social media. It has made them incredibly independent because they have everything that they need right there through the internet. They don't have mentors or coaches or teachers. They've got it all right there. It has obviously exposed them to, for the first time, they have a generation raised on pornography. And one of the things that I mentioned in the book that it also means is that they have virtually limitless access to information, but almost no wisdom. No wisdom. And so all of these things are brand new. And I spend a fair amount of time in the book kind of extrapolating the significance of simply having not just the internet, but the iPhone. We forget how new this is, Neil. I mean, if you were a teenager or a college student in the 90s, you probably didn't even have the internet.
Yeah.
I mean, that didn't even start to take hold until later on in that decade. I mean, the difference between a 35-year-old millennial and a 15 or 17-year-old Gen Z, light years. These are two radically different animals on the basis of just technology and the internet alone.
Talking Generation Z, and the subtitle of James Emery White's new book is called Understanding and Reaching the New Post-Christian World. So how do we reach this generation, this significant generation? Are there models we can adopt? Can we do evangelism and apologetics the same way? We'll get to that and more. We're going to talk about childhood and about ideology and all those things coming up. By the way, we've got a couple of copies of James' book to give away and would love to get one in your hands. You have hopefully a passion and interest in this area. It is just such an eye-opening book. You'll enjoy reading it. Meet Generation Z is the name of the book, and you can sign up for a copy. We'll do a drawing at the top of the hour. It's 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And if you have a question for us, you can join in as well. James Emery White is a founding and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church, and he's my guest today in Connecting Faith, and we'll talk more in just a moment. We're talking about Generation Z. It's a new generation, making up more than 25% of the U.S. population. Think about that. That represents a seismic cultural shift. Born approximately between 1993 and 2012, Generation Z is the first truly post-Christian generation, and they are poised to change and challenge every church to rethink its role in light of a rapidly changing culture. We're talking culture today with James Emery White. James actually writes at the website churchandculture.org. I recommend it to you, churchandculture.org. You can learn more about his writings. He's a founding and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church, written books like The Rise of the Nuns, Rethinking the Church, The Church in an Age of Crisis. We're talking Generation Z today, his latest. James, in the book, you suggest that we're not only losing Generation Z ideologically, but relationally. Explain more about that.
One of the reasons that we're losing them relationally is because older generations don't relate the way they relate, and they largely relate through technology. And so if you are not able to converse with them, relate with them the way they are relating with their friends, then you're largely isolating yourself from them. That's one of the major reasons why. And I'm not talking Facebook, because Generation Z is not particularly on Facebook. They consider that for old folk, like millennials. I mean, they're much more like Snapchat and Whisper and perhaps Instagram. But they do love YouTube. They do love YouTube. That is their go-to source for just about everything, because they're such a visually oriented generation, and go there for their humor. They go there for, they go there just as much for news as they do anywhere else. So, but we are losing them relationally, because not only is there the technological kind of divide, but the typical church and leaders of the church just don't know these people. They're not in relationship with them. And by and large, Generation Z isn't in the church either. And so there's just a huge divide. Most churches tend to cater to the already convinced. They tend to speak to the already convinced. And so there is a huge relational divorce between the average Christian and non-Christian of any generation. And it's just simply more dramatic with Generation Z.
You know, we used to think that, every young adult sort of has this season where they maybe wander away, or, they have to sort of test the faith, make it their own, and then, they get married, have children, they come back. That's never really been the case with this group, right? I mean, as you said right at the beginning, they haven't even been thinking about it.
They get more secular. They get less tied to the church as they get older. And that's a first as well. And I think that's also a mark of the post-Christian context that they're in. It used to be that the overarching Christian cultural pressure would kind of steer them back toward the church as they got into adulthood. That is not the case for Generation Z, and one of the reasons is that culture doesn't exist anymore.
Well, if they're unchurched, I mean, the nuns, as you said, are a growing number. The unchurched aren't interested in engaging the church, so is the church equipped, or is that the only way to reach this generation, or does it have to be done through a parachurch or some other way?
Well, heaven forbid. The parachurch should not, heaven forbid that the church should abdicate its role to the parachurch. Mm-hmm. The church is Christ's dream, and what Christ has instituted for ministry and outreach and for the gospel going forward in this world. That is the heart of the mission. That is the vanguard. There is no plan B. What needs to happen is that the church needs to realize that it is a new day. And this is how I describe it in the book. We need to realize that we've moved from an Acts 2 cultural context to an Acts 17 cultural context. And here's what I mean by that. In Acts chapter 2, you have Peter speaking before the God-fearing Jews of Jerusalem. When you study that message, it's fascinating what he can assume that they already know and believe that he can instantly build off of. And in essence, and this is a gross paraphrase, but in essence he says, all right, you guys know all about, the Old Testament scriptures, you know about Moses, you know about the prophets, you know about all the things being foretold by the coming of the Messiah. Okay, that was Jesus. You killed him. He rose again from the dead, which means you're screwed. Repent and be saved. 3,000 did. It wasn't even the length of a good blog. Fast forward to Acts 17. You have Paul and Mars Hill. Totally different context. They didn't have any knowledge of the Old Testament scriptures, much less the specifics of it, the messianic prophecies and Moses and the Jewish people. And I mean, they knew nothing. All they could agree on was that you couldn't know anything, which is what the shrine to the unknown God was about. It was essentially a shrine to Gnosticism. So what did Paul do? Well, he was a good missiologist. He read that setting perfectly. He didn't even begin with Jesus. He went all the way back to creation and began to work his way forward because he had so much explanation to do. And then at the end, a handful responded. Well, welcome to our world. We are in an Acts 17 world. Now, what's killing the church is that we're taking an Acts 2 approach to an Acts 17 world, and we're wondering why it doesn't work.
James, I know you address, one of the challenges is that today's Generation Z, Minds aren't necessarily open to rigorous thought or ideas that might be contrary to their easily offended sensibilities. So how do we engage a generation that maybe doesn't want to hear something that seems offensive or narrow?
Well, I think that what you're referring to is a supposed snowflake mentality present on some colleges in their effort of saying, okay, this offends me, so I don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
I think a lot of students that react that way get the press, but the average Gen Z person is quite frankly wide open to robust ideas. It's just a question of, are you going to get their attention and communicate it in a way that is winsome and compelling to them? And unfortunately, many perspectives that are alien to them, that they aren't exposed to, but they would engage and perhaps be open to, are not presented in a winsome and compelling way. So many speakers for the Christian faith have a belligerent, arrogant, baseball bat approach, as if I can shout at you or beat you up with an idea, I've somehow gained ground with you. Well, that's absurd. It doesn't work for anybody. We need to figure out how can we build cultural bridges of understanding, begin explaining the Christian faith to them, and answering their very honest and fair questions about it in light of their post-Christian context. And do it in a way where we don't get mad at them for holding to different views. What do we expect? They're not Christians. They haven't been raised in a Christian culture. We should expect these things and not be offended by them ourselves or get mad at them for believing them.
I think you used an illustration where, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, I mean, maybe the Acts 2 model there, maybe at a 7 or 8, the Acts 17 model there, maybe a 2 or a 3, and that's kind of where we are today, isn't it? We have a long way of, I guess, explaining and conversation to go.
Yes. I talk about it in terms of evangelism. We're so used to it being simply event-oriented, proclamation-oriented, the Billy Graham crusade, where he would say, the Bible says. But we now need to recapture a sense of evangelism as process and event, moving them down the field of understanding to where they can even responsibly respond to the gospel.
We're going to talk more about it. What does that look like in practice? We'll get some insight from how James Emery White seeks to do that at Mecklenburg Community Church, where he is the founding senior pastor. It's suburban large megachurch in Charlotte, North Carolina, and he has authored a number of books, including The Rise of the Nuns, Rethinking the Church, The Church in Age of Crisis. The book we're referencing today, Meet Generation Z, Understanding and Reaching the New Post-Christian World. We'll talk more about how we reach today's generation, maybe some advice for church leaders, for moms and dads as well. We got some copies of Generation Z to give away. I always love to make those resources available. We'll do the drawing for that at the top of the hour, a couple of copies. So you can give us a call and sign up for that at 877-933-2484. That's 877-93-FAITH. And sign up for a copy of Meet Generation Z. And you can also join us with a question. We'll talk more with James Emery White in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. Well, the good news is that the message of the gospel is still good news for every generation, certainly for Generation Z. We're learning about them. Meet Generation Z is the title of a new book from James Emery White, the subtitle Understanding and Reaching the New Post-Christian World. James is founding senior pastor at Mecklenburg Community Church, Charlotte, North Carolina, is a best-selling author, and he blogs and writes regularly at the website churchandculture.org. I recommend it to you. I want to bookmark and to go there regularly, churchandculture.org, for some good thinking on this topic. And James, let's talk about that. Christianity is still uniquely suited to answer the questions of this generation, is it? We don't have to fear that somehow the gospel isn't sufficient.
Correct. You know, the problem is not in our message. It's in our methods. It's not in the truth of the gospel. It's in knowing the best way to know how to communicate that truth. And so that's one of the things that's often forgotten. Some people tend to think that, well, I mean, are you saying we need to abandon orthodoxy in order to get warm bodies, or we have to water things down to reach a generation that's post-Christian? And I would say, oh my gosh, no, the exact opposite. I mean, keep it robust, keep it the full truth of the gospel. This is all about methodology. This is all about approach. It's all about communication styles and approaches. It's not about changing the message. It's about changing the message. I write a lot about how there's a difference between translation and transformation. To transform the gospel would be heresy. To translate it into the language of the day and the culture we're trying to reach is missionary work 101. And so we're constantly having to find the best way to translate it. And so that's really what we're talking about here in terms of reaching this new generation.
So maybe give us an example or two or some ways that you've worked through that at Mecklenburg, which has been traditionally you've been focusing on the younger generation since the beginning. But, you know, this is you maybe can't even do a church the way you used to do it, 10, 15 years ago.
Well, at Mac, we have over 70% of our growth comes from the previously unchurched, which I know is a staggeringly high number, but it just is what it has been like from day one. So 7 out of every 10 of the people we're reaching were unchurched. And we've skewed younger every year for the last, 10 years at least. And one of the things that that I encourage churches to do and leaders to be thinking about is to realize that you have to create, you can't have this, come to us kind of mentality. You have to have a church that is radically turned outward, where the people that are in the church who are Christ followers are actively building and intentionally developing relationships with those who are outside of the church. And then through that relationship, be extending these personal invitations to explore and to check things out, which largely begins usually through a church's website first and then later on maybe through activity or an event. But that means, too, that when they do eventually come to the context of a relationship, you need to have an appropriately open front door. In other words, and I'm not advocating for a particular style of service or anything like that. I'm not trying to get into the worship wars. I am saying that whatever you do needs to be freshly viewed through the eyes of someone who is spiritually and biblically illiterate, through someone who has no knowledge, who has no experience. And you have to ask yourself, will this make sense to them? How can I best explain this to them? At Mac, when I deliver a talk, when we do a service, we assume that the average person sitting there is clueless. Doesn't mean we don't have a full-orbed Christian worship experience or it's not a good, solid message. We just have a different set of assumptions. We explain things that the average church wouldn't explain. We interpret things the average church wouldn't interpret. We build bridges intentionally as we get into subjects that the average church wouldn't even think about needing to have to build. Because we take for granted that 7 out of every 10 people coming are coming from an unchurched background. And that changes everything when you have those kinds of presuppositions.
Well, I guess maybe as you said, if we're living in that Acts 17 model, then that's it's going to be a lot more, I think, as you said, process rather than event. That's okay. We don't have to get maybe quite as tense about getting the whole message all at one time.
Well, sure. I mean, what you're doing is that when you realize that person's starting point is radically different than a person's starting point was even 20 years ago. That's just part of reading culture. That's just part of staying culturally current. That's just part of keeping a methodology sharp And this also goes into, and you and I were talking about this off air, this goes into apologetics too. Apologetics is right now in need and should be in the process of a complete overhaul. Most Christians who are versed in apologetics are versed in kind of what I call the old school apologetics, the Josh McDowell, Lee Strobel types. Don't get me wrong. Love those guys. Love that niche of apologetics. It's very evidentialist based, and that still is needed, and it's important to know. But the questions are changing now that people are asking. They're not asking what essentially the old school apologetics was built on, an Enlightenment set of questions based on the Enlightenment era. You know, is the Bible true? Prove that Jesus rose from the dead. Those kinds of questions, very Enlightenment based, dealing with rationalism and the challenges of science. Generation Z is not asking those questions at all. I mean, at least not much. If you were to say the Bible is true, let me prove it to you, their response would be, so what if it is? If you were to say Jesus rose from the dead, they would say, so what if he did? You could say, well, let me prove to you that he did. That's not where there's itching. It's the so what questions. And it's also like being wide open to, like, okay, I'm wide open to the fact that Jesus rose from the dead, but can you tell me why that would matter? Most Christians, surprisingly, are not able to answer that very effectively. The other set of questions that they tend to have, Neil, is what I would call the neo-atheist questions that flow from Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins. Now, the average Gen Z person, the average unchurched person, has not read them. They may not even know the names. But the arguments of the neo-atheists that were propagated in their writings have made it to the Facebook page and the blogs, and they're the most popularized arguments against religion and the Christian faith. And so they're familiar with it like two or three steps removed. And most of those questions aren't even about whether God exists. It's about this God the Bible says exists, that he's a moral monster, that who would ever want a God like that, who commits genocide against the Canaanites, who tells someone to offer up their son as a human sacrifice, who had 16 or 17 different sins that were capital offenses, who has imprecatory psalms about bashing babies' heads on rocks. What kind of God is this? And that's a huge set of questions for Generation Z. I hear about this God of yours. I'm not sure I like him. And so apologetics has changed in terms of answering these kinds of questions that are fair questions. They're fair questions. They're simply asking them and raising what they've heard and what they've read in the echo chamber of the Internet.
So you said some of those things don't matter to them. Talk about maybe what matters, and then how do we, is there, obviously not one answer, but maybe one step we can take to have a prophetic voice and yet to relate on the level of the Gen Z questions.
You know, one of the things that's interesting about them, there's two areas that I think, and I write about this in the book, that I think provide natural bridges that we can walk across and get into spiritual conversations with them that they're wide open to. One is, and again, remembering that the new apologetic is really explanation. I mean, that it's moved from evidence to explanation. That's kind of the headline. But there's two things. They're wide open to the supernatural. You know, the ethos of the Enlightenment era non-Christian was that everything was materialistic and rational. Generation Z, and I would argue even many millennials, but Generation Z for sure is wide open to supernatural. They may not, buy into Jesus or God, but they certainly believe in ghosts and the spiritual world. And that gives us a bridge to walk across because we believe in that world too. We may know that it's not really a ghost, but it's a demon, but we still have a map of the spiritual world that we can use as a bridge to walk across and talk with them about, because they really do believe in the supernatural, and they're fascinated by the supernatural, and they believe it exists. Another thing about them that I think provides a bridge to walk across is, and this is going to sound counterintuitive to people, but it's cosmology. They are taken with the wonders of the universe, the size and the grandeur of it, and they will say that if there is anything that makes them posit the existence of God, it's the width and breadth and wonder and majesty of the cosmos. So rather than that aspect of science driving them away from God, it kind of, to them, is one great big huge pointer that maybe there is something bigger than they are. And, of course, that's a door we can walk through. It's kind of like in the early chapter of Romans, Paul says that no matter how illiterate you may be, the heavens declare. So that's the kind of bridge that we can walk across as well. And actually, in the book, I give two sample messages that I gave here at MAC, one on the occult and one on cosmology, that were samples of how you might could talk to Generation Z over these bridges. So I think that's another aspect of the new apologetics. Find the new topics that give you an entree into their world and their thinking.
James Emery White has been doing it for many years, founder and senior pastor of Mecklenburg Community Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. He writes regularly at the website churchandculture.org, churchandculture.org, and I recommend it to you. The new book, Meet Generation Z, Understanding and Reaching the New Post-Christian World. It's a great read, a wonderful resource, as always, whatever James Emery White writes, I always like to read, and I recommend the book to you, and you can get a copy. We've got a couple of copies we'll give away here at the top of the hour. 877-933-2484 is the phone number, 877-93-FAITH. By the way, James, one of our listeners want to know, where does the name Generation Z come from?
Well, the millennials are the, the busters were, millennials are Generation Y, and so busters were Generation X, and so they just decided to call the next one Z.
Okay, all right, That's a simple, and it may be the last one, right, based on in terms of generations changing so much faster than ever before. You'll find it fascinating reading. James, always good to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks, Neil.
James Emery White joining us today here on Connecting Faith. I encourage you to stay tuned. We're going to connect with Lisa Moreau, and our Monday Health Moment is coming up here just ahead. Nice to have you along in Connecting Faith here, 47 past the hour, and welcome to this first Monday in June, it is, isn't it, Aaron? Yeah, so I'm gone last week. I don't really know what time or day it is, but anyway, we know that it's time for Lisa Marone. She visits with us every other Monday for a little Monday Health Moment. In fact, she blogs lisamarone.com. You can sign up for your own health moment, read it regularly, and get some encouragement. Well, June is Men's Health Month, and so we're going to talk about men's health today with Lisa. Good to have you back, Lisa. Welcome.
Hey, Neil. It's great to be back. I hope you enjoyed your time off.
It was great, but I guess I can't just sort of take time off from good health, and that's what we're going to talk about today, right? What do guys need to know about good health?
You know, after treating patients for about the past 28 years, I've come to find out something about men when I evaluate them. One of the questions that I ask, regardless of why they're coming for physical therapy, is, tell me when your last trip to the doctor was for a physical. And there's usually crickets in the room, and then they try to remember, and they say, maybe 3 years ago, I'm not quite sure. And I ask about certain doctor visits, and they've not had tests or scheduled tests that they should have had done. And so I just really feel June being National Men's Health Month, there is a reason for that. And I just wanted to kind of give that little extra push for the men out there to get themselves to their doctors for their regular visits.
Well, let's talk about it. Important annual medical visits. I know you break it down by age, so let's do that. If we're under 50, what do we need to be thinking about?
Yeah, if you're a man and you're under 50 years old, you have an easier time with your doctor's visits. There's really only three major things. If you're a generally healthy person that you do need to do, you need to go to your general physician's office, your primary care physician, and you need to have an annual exam. Even if you're healthy, you need to get an annual exam, and they're going to look at your blood pressure, your heart rate, your body weight. They need to do a full blood work panel. Our blood is really like our body's chemistry. And we want to have especially an A1C test done, and that's going to tell us how we're metabolizing our blood sugar. And most doctors' offices, their general doctors, are running an EKG, that's an electrocardiogram, taking a look at your heart, because anything that's kind of starting to get out of whack, it's earlier the better that we find those things out. So even if you feel well, that's one of the first things under 50.
And I know you've written a lot about, you know, blood sugar and insulin, and so that A1C test is pretty important, isn't it?
It is, and why I mention it specifically is because I would say about 50% of your general doctors are doing that as a regular habit, you know, a regular part of their blood work, and the others might need a little bit of questioning, just, hey, could I have this done? Because it's really a much more accurate way to look at blood sugar metabolism than the fasting glucose test, which is what the American Medical Association has recommended. So that's the first thing. The second thing, Neil, we need to get to the dentist for general checkups and cleanings. Some people's insurance plans cover that twice a year, so that's even better if you get there every 6 months. But at least annually, and Neil, this is what's so fascinating, is that if you have inflammation in your gums, and that might be light inflammation like gingivitis where you bleed a little bit while you're brushing your teeth, or if you have periodontitis, which is a little bit more severe where you're having some pockets of inflammation and bacterial growth, both of those things actually are related to an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and stroke. Because inflammation in the gum line and all that bacteria, the gums are very vascular, and so that bacteria gets into the body, and it lands itself in the heart, and also the inflammation process. Cardiovascular disease is becoming a real, the spotlight is on inflammation with that, and so if we keep good, healthy gums, we actually protect ourselves from cardiovascular disease.
All right, so we go to the doctor for the regular checkup, we go to the dentist. You also have one more listed.
Yeah, you know, it's really important that we go get our eyes examined. That could be from an ophthalmologist. It could be an optometrist, depending upon how your insurance company works. But we do want to see that our vision is good, because especially as we get, you know, 40 years and on, we're going to start to lose some of our reading vision. But we always want to be on the lookout for glaucoma, for macular degeneration, for cataract growth. Again, the earlier we find these things, the better off we are in terms of treating them and protecting our vision. So under 50, those are the three things that I would recommend.
Well, so over 50, I know you recommend those three, but there's a few more specifically, right?
Yeah, so over 50, you know, I just turned 50 this January, so you can chalk up a couple of extra doctor visits for the year. You need to celebrate your 50th birthday with scheduling a visit to get a colonoscopy. People do not like to hear that. That just makes them all squeamish. But I tell people, listen, I know people who have put this off for decades and have been diagnosed later with colon cancer, which is very advanced. Colon cancer usually gets diagnosed at its advanced stages. When you now have to remove a large part of your intestines, you're wearing a colostomy bag outside your body. So if you're squeamish about getting a colonoscopy, think about what could be the end result. So just get that done. It's just you get it done once when you're 50, and usually if you're clear, you don't have to go for another 5 or 10 years. So get that done. That's your birthday gift to yourself.
And at least my doctors now, they're done with the anesthesia. You don't really even, I mean, it's not even an issue, really.
Yeah, it's really quick. You know, it's the prep time before that people don't like.
Yeah.
It takes a day out of your life.
Yeah, well, it's one day.
Get a good book.
Sure. All right. Other things, over 50.
Yeah, over 50, men, we really want you to visit your urologist. And there's two reasons for that. The first reason is that as you get older, you can begin to lose the levels of testosterone in your body. You can start to drop in that category. And what you're going to notice if you're dropping in your testosterone is you're going to have some muscle weakness that you might say, just age-related. You're going to lose some mental focus. You might also say, well, that's just age-related. Hair loss, some agitated mood swings, maybe some depression. And you might just chalk that up to age. And, yeah, it kind of is because of age, because as you're getting older, you may start to lower your testosterone levels. So go into the urologist, have that checked. It's an easy fix. You get a gel cream with some testosterone, you rub it on your shoulders in the morning time. So if you want to get a clearer mind, you want to stop your hair loss and have your muscles as strong as they were when you were younger, that's an important thing. And then the second thing, Neil, at the urologist, is we really need to make sure that our prostate, that men's prostates are healthy. And prostate cancer is something that, again, if it is identified early, it's super treatable, wonderful results with that. And interestingly, you don't know that you have a prostate issue until it's pretty advanced. So it doesn't begin to show signs in you. So it is really good that even though you're feeling perfect and you think everything is well, that you do have that visit to your urologist after 50.
You know, and both these, whether it's a colonoscopy or, you know, a prostate exam, I mean, all these things, early detection really is a lifesaver. So we just can't emphasize that enough. You mentioned a couple others, too, for those 50, men 50 and above, a couple things to get checked.
Yeah, men 50 and above, we need to be at the cardiologist. It's really important that a cardiologist looks at your heart, and they're going to look at your heart in some different ways. They're going to look at plaquing. Many of them will run sonograms of your carotid arteries in your neck. They might run sonograms of the arteries in your brain. They're looking for plaquing. If you can get on a little bit of statins and you have plaquing, that plaque will reduce and you can really prevent yourself from getting heart attack or stroke. And so, again, after about 50, you know, we've been putting on some weight. Sometimes we're more sedentary in our jobs. And it's really critical that at this time in our lives that we start to take a better look at your heart. So your general physician will run an EKG, but there's going to be other things after 50 that you want a cardiologist to take a look at. And just a baseline. You can go for a baseline. They can say, you're beautiful. Don't come back for 10 years. Or a few years ago, one of my readers contacted me after I ran this Monday morning health tip in June a number of years ago, and she said, hey, I just need to tell you, that this week you saved my husband's life. I bugged him to go to the doctor. He went to his cardiologist. They found a blockage in his heart. They scheduled emergency surgery for him. He had a stent put in, and you saved his life. And so I just want to tell you out there, men and women who love your men, just get them out to the doctor because it's so critical. These time-sensitive issues are really important to take a look at.
Got a minute for one more to touch on as well.
Yeah, the last thing is just get yourself to a dermatologist, men and women. After 50 years old, you've been 5 decades in the sun. There are areas in your body that you can't see well. You probably are not taking a mirror looking at the back of your legs or your back. And so it's really important that a dermatologist takes a quick look at you and make sure, declares that you are cancer-free. There's no precancerous growths that need to be removed. Because melanoma is one of the most aggressive and dangerous cancers. So that's my last little advice for men during this month of June.
And maybe just, is there one exercise basic, I guess, besides doing something, just being active?
You know, exercise has been shown in every study to improve everything, from colon cancer to dementia to cardiovascular disease to cancer. So just get moving. It's so important. I'm not just saying that because I'm a physical therapist. Every scientific study that comes out, the people who are moving are going to be healthier overall, and you want to age well and live long so we can serve Jesus with great strength.
We're talking, Lisa Marone's passion is to help us get healthy for heaven's sake, because there's work to do in God's kingdom. She's given us some great advice, physical therapist, speaker, author, and you can find out more on her website, lisamarone.com, and she's a regular guest here on Connecting Faith every other Monday. You can get the Monday Health Minute from Lisa. Sign up for that today on our website, lisamarone.com. Lisa, blessings to you. Thanks for the good encouragement today.
Thanks, Neil.
You're listening to Connecting Faith. If you missed part of today's conversation, our earlier visit with James Emery White, or want to just review what Lisa had to say just these past few moments, you know, we post those interviews on our Connecting Faith show page. You can go to myfaithradio.com. to find out more. That's myfaithradio.com, and then click on Connecting Faith. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.